The Word of Mouth podcast from NHPR is made possible with support from you, our subscribers, and from
Heinemann, a provider of resources written by real teachers for real classrooms. Heinemann values teachers as decision makers and students as curious learners. Discover the path to lifelong professional learning at Heinemann.com. Heinemann, dedicated to teachers.
I don't know if you have a couple minutes. If we have time, we'd love to let you try some stuff out.
Let's see what time it is. We've got to have a couple minutes.
So the other day, I'm at Southern New Hampshire University in Manchester, and a couple of professors there, Ed Brillant and David Carrig, they take me into this lab.
So this is one of the things I've always
There's a carpet, whiteboard on the wall, some computers around the edge of the room.
This lab has a handful of really high-end PCs. These are probably the highest NPCs that are on campus. They're insane.
But mostly it's like a big empty room. And as far as labs go, it's super boring. It's like there's no beakers, there's no chemicals, you know, none of that stuff. Which is important because, and this explains why the room is mostly empty, is because this is a virtual reality laboratory.
All right. Well, do me a favor. Why don't you take this? Because I'll need to document.
I can do that.
I put on the headset, and it's not empty at all. In fact, I'm standing on the deck of a sunken ship at the bottom of the ocean.
Wow. Oh, my goodness.
Well, what did you do?
So I was just kind of standing there, and there's, like, fish, and, you know, it's pretty, and I'm looking around, and then this huge whale comes by me, and its tail gets so close that I actually, like, I ducked instinctually.
Wow. The fact that you just flinched when that happened is fantastic. And what you're looking at, this is probably developed, like, 3 years ago.
It was pretty insane.
I've never done virtual reality, and I've always wanted to. Like, did you feel like any minute you could actually get hit by this whale?
Oh, absolutely. And after the underwater world, they put me into another virtual reality scene.
This is the demo I like to put people in when they kind of don't believe that virtual reality can create some sort of compelling experience.
It's like a city street, kind of cartoonish but good graphics. And they tell me to turn around, and turn around, there's like an open elevator inside of the skyscraper. So I get in, I press the button, it brings me somewhere, you know, and then the doors open and I'm looking out over the whole city. It's just open air. There's nothing in front of me except maybe like a 4 or 5 foot plank, like a pirate ship.
I'm like terrified even just thinking about this. Even when you said there was like a big building with an open elevator, I was like,
are you afraid of heights?
Like without a railing, without feeling like and being protected.
Did you walk the plank?
So all I'm gonna ask you to do is just walk to the end of that plank, if you don't mind.
Ooh, jeez.
Feel a little vertigo on that?
Yeah. Yeah, that's pretty crazy.
We won't do it, but this is definitely the time where we push you.
I'm not in this space with you, but my palms are sweating just thinking about this.
I would love to do this, more than anything. I always thought virtual reality was gonna be a fad, and then it was going to disappear. But it seems like it's getting better and better, and this is something I'm just desperate to do.
And these guys are, you know, what they're telling me is that this is the future.
There's that, yeah, wow. Wow, I'm having trouble articulating. That's amazing.
See, we did tell you, like, there's no words that we can say, hey, this is really crazy, but until you get into it, you're like, whoa, this is pretty crazy.
This is Word of Mouth. Your questions answered, your state explored. I'm Erica Janik, here today with producers Taylor Quimby and Nick Capodice. Ed and David set up the virtual reality lab at SNHU because they're trying to make sure that their students are learning to use the newest, most cutting-edge tech in the industry, that they'll be able to participate in the future of video games. But here in New Hampshire, they're also in close proximity to the industry's past and the birth of video gaming as we know it. Today, we're talking all about Granite State Gaming, and we're starting with a piece by producer Justine Paradise for our series, New Hampshire Firsts.
There's this TV show from the 1970s called What's My Line? It's kind of a quiz show feel, where some ordinary Joe would come on the show, and celebrity panelists would try to guess what that person did for a living.
Would our next challenger enter and sign in, please?
In this show, the host and the evening's guest, a product manager at the electronics company Magnavox, play tennis on a screen, which is hidden from the panelists as they try to figure out what's going on.
You're doing something sassy.
Sassy?
Are you reproducing something on that television screen?
Reproducing something? In what sense?
Is there a picture of some kind on the screen?
Of some kind, yes.
The audience can see the game, and the graphics are pretty simple, almost just calculator pixels. There are two paddles, each represented by a line and a circle for the ball.
Can we assume, though, that you are controlling the picture in some way?
Yes, you can.
Most of us would probably recognize the expression on the host's face, but it's pretty confusing to the panelists. It is the expression of a gamer at play, totally focused yet distant, and really struggling to carry on a conversation while playing.
You're so busy doing what you're doing, you don't know what's happening.
That's true.
To be fair, well, it's kind of unreasonable to ask people to guess at a completely new invention.
Supposed to be guessing.
I don't know
what this is for.
What you're doing is an offense to nature. I mean,
no, it is no offense to nature. We are playing tennis.
Oh.
But finally, the hosts reveal. They are playing tennis on the TV using the newly invented Magnavox Odyssey game console.
This idea of playing a game on a TV was something that was completely foreign to people who only associated TVs with watching.
That's John Paul Dyson, or JP. He's director of the International Center of the History of Electronic Games at the Strong Museum of Play.
So the Magnavox Odyssey was really crucial in bringing video games into the home and really turning Americans into game players.
The Magnavox Odyssey was the first home video game system.
It was developed by a guy named Ralph Baer, who was working for a company called Sanders, which was a defense contractor in New Hampshire.
Manchester is where he spent most of his adult life.
That's Mark Baer, Ralph's son. He says that in the 1930s, Ralph and his family were living in Germany, and they were Jewish. In 1938...
he had to run away from the Germans in the late 30s. You know, 2 months before Kristallnacht, the family got out. 2 months later, no getting out. Wouldn't have been here.
They emigrated to New York. During World War II, Ralph was drafted and served in the U.S. Army and military intelligence. After that, he went to school for television engineering, worked in the electronics industry, and eventually got a job at Sanders and moved to New Hampshire in 1956. Ralph had the idea for what would become the Magnavox Odyssey while he was on a business trip in New York, waiting for the bus. And true to his engineering training, he made sure to document the idea in his notes.
He was the, in many ways, the quintessential little German engineer that you would expect, you know. He wrote everything down. He often said, you know, if you don't write it down, it didn't happen.
Ralph developed a prototype at Sanders called the Brown Box, and that's actually now in the collections at the Smithsonian. They licensed the game to Magnavox, and it was released in 1972 as a TV game. The term video game wasn't being used yet.
What does your family do on those stay-indoors rainy afternoons? Or on those cold, blustery winter days?
That's an ad for Magnavox Odyssey from 1972. It explains that the console comes with 12 different program cards. You could play sports like tennis and hockey, kids' games like Simon Says and Haunted House, plus roulette and a game of strategy called Analogic.
Families who are content to let television do its thing often find themselves at its mercy for a choice of entertainment, while people who want television to do their thing entertain themselves with Odyssey. The electronic game of the future, and the family's best foul-weather friend.
Again, the graphics were not advanced, and the Odyssey actually came with a big box of accessories, including transparent overlays to place over the screen for each game. So, for example, for the tennis game, you'd have a transparent overlay of a court and a net to bring the game to life.
And you're ready to begin an exciting, fast-paced tennis game.
But of course, the real innovation wasn't the gameplay or the graphics. It was the fact that anyone with a TV could play games in their living room.
So video games have had a transformative effect on the way we play, the way we learn, the way we interact with the digital world.
That's JP Dyson again from the Museum of Play.
And video games are often the way that kids especially become digital natives. It's how they become comfortable with this idea of interacting with this virtual world that's happening on a screen. And so the Odyssey was key in really launching this home video game revolution. This one thing to go and play a game in an arcade, maybe, but to play it in your home, that's a much more intimate way of experiencing it, and it's a way that really makes you much more comfortable, I think, with the idea that, oh, I can interact in this world.
The Magnavox Odyssey wasn't a giant commercial success, but it did okay. The first generation sold for $99 a game, which is equivalent to about $600 today. It sold about 350,000 units. And after Magnavox Odyssey came The Industry.
In many ways, we're trending to the point where everyone will be a gamer of some kind, because devices to play games have become ubiquitous in our lives. You think if you have a cell phone in your pocket, for instance, there's a good chance there's a game on there. Now, it may be a pretty involved game like Minecraft, or it could be just a quick game like Candy Crush that you might play as a casual game. And so as screens have become omnipresent in our lives, and as generation after generation of kids have grown up playing games, we're getting to the point where we won't differentiate between gamers and non-gamers, just as we don't differentiate between, say, movie watchers and non-movie watchers. Some people are hardcore movie watchers and they watch a lot. Some people only catch a film every once in a while, but pretty much everyone watches a movie at some point.
And as for Ralph Baer, the Odyssey wasn't his only invention. He also came up with the pattern game Simon and created military applications of video games too. He's been called the father of video games, and in 2006, he was honored by President George W. Bush with a National Medal of Technology. And his son Mark says he never stopped inventing.
He'd come home, he'd have dinner with us, he'd go down to the basement and work in his lab. His vocation, avocation, habit, hobby, fun, got to do it. It was all, you know, about his work. He just...
About inventing?
Yeah, about inventing, building this stuff.
Baer died in 2014 at the age of 92 at his home in Manchester. And this year, the Manchester Historical Society is actually involved in a project to honor him in the city.
They've decided to put in a commemorative bench down in the Mill Yard District, just off the river, in honor of Dad and honor of Ralph.
The project was successfully crowdfunded on Kickstarter, and plans are underway to install the bench and a statue of Ralph later on this year.
The idea is to sort of like transition the past of New Hampshire's technical past and prowess and accomplishment, and it's kind of embodied in Ralph's life, transition that into what's going on now and what's going to go on in the future.
It's a nod to the city's spirit of tech and innovation, past and future.
That was producer Justine Paradise, who is on vacation this week. I'm Erica Janik in the studio with Taylor Quimby and Nick Capodice. Taylor, you and Justine actually went to play the Magnavox Odyssey, didn't you?
Well, kind of. We it wasn't technically the Magnavox Odyssey, but there is the Pong game that is basically a ripoff of the Magnavox Odyssey. And that is located, there's an old Pong at Fun Spot in Laconia. Nick, you know Fun Spot.
Oh,
we're both fans.
Oh, very well. Actually, one of my very first things I did in New Hampshire as a kid is I recorded a radio commercial for the Lakes region, including an ad for Fun Spot.
What?
Yeah.
How did it go?
Oh, God. I was a character named Tommy Idaho Jones telling my class about how great the Lakes region was. And the line was, and then we went to Fun Spot where we sharpened our reflexes on video games.
So for listeners who don't know and haven't seen that ad with Nick Capodice.
As Tommy Idaho Jones.
Fun Spot is billed as the largest arcade in the world. I don't know whether or not that's true. There's another arcade that calls itself the largest in the United States. So obviously both of those can't be true. it's this, you know, huge arcade. There's like a bowling alley. There's bumper cars. There's
mini
all sorts
golf.
Of mini golf.
Yeah.
And the top floor is the American Classic Arcade Museum. This is where they house like all their super old school ones. So Justine and I got to play Pong.
Had you played before?
Oh my God. It's fun. Let's see.
Insert the quarter for two players. One quarter for two players.
Ready?
Yeah, ready. Oh, that's my paddle. Okay.
Yep. Oh, it's so small.
It's hard.
That is
like two little lads. Oh, hey.
Who won?
Some
sense of
physics, I kick butt it. Pong.
It doesn't go that way.
But Justine whooped me at air hockey later.
That's a virtual and analog version of the same game right there. So she's nailing it in the real world, and you're nailing it in the virtual one.
Yeah, yeah. But to transition to our next story here, because there was this amazing moment of serendipity when we were there, because at the arcade museum part, we decided, hey, let's go over and check out the Donkey Kong console.
You want to go see if anybody's playing Donkey Kong?
And we walk over there, and there's this dude sitting on a chair, kind of, you know, stooped over, playing the game.
Da-da. Someone's on it.
And then, Nick, you were on vacation that day. We happen to run into you at the same moment. You're standing there. And all of a sudden, like, we realize we're witnessing a bit of history, because the guy who's sitting in this chair is Robbie Lakeman, the holder of the world record for the highest Donkey Kong score.
Are you Robbie?
Yeah.
Hey, what's up? I'm Taylor from NHPR.
We're gonna
hang out next week.
Oh, okay. Oh, cool.
Yeah, well, I'm actually a level and a half from the kill screen, so you showed up at a good time. Yeah.
Erica, do you know what a kill screen is?
No.
So, real quickly, Donkey Kong is an old arcade game, and the point is that you're on a construction site. You are Mario, but back then they called him Jumpman, and you are trying to save the princess from Donkey Kong, a giant gorilla who is at the top of the screen throughout the game. There's all sorts of ladders and sort of like steel beams kind of thing, and there's fireballs and barrels that he's throwing at you and all sorts of stuff. And the kill screen is this glitch that happens in this game and others from the era, where basically the engineers who created it never expected people to get too far. You know, they've designed it to kill you earlier on in the game. And if you keep going and going and going, eventually it has this sort of Y2K glitch and it just suddenly stops. You'll be in the middle of a level and Jumpman just dies. Anyway, these kill screen things, these are like kind of a big deal. So by the time it finished, there was, I don't know, like 6-7 people sort of standing around. And there was even this moment of spontaneous applause when it happened.
Cool.
Yeah. That strain.
How long did you have to play?
That was like an hour and a half, maybe.
And what's really wild is apparently Robbie Lakeman, world record Donkey Kong holder, lives about two blocks from my house in Concord, New Hampshire.
Amazing.
So I went and talked to him. I cannot believe that I've been living, you know, like I'm a game fan. I've saw King of Kong, and I've been living two blocks away from the world champ.
Yeah, it's funny too, because whenever I go, people don't really like know about it, but my friends like to talk about it all the time. So, yeah, there's always those awkward moments where like they're like, "Oh my god, that's so cool! Like we didn't know that you lived here." But
so how did you get into it? I mean, what gets you into like competitive Kong?
Yeah, I've been doing this since about 2011. That's when I got into like the competitive side. I always went to Fun Spot as a kid, so but I never played I always played like the Tiga game, so I never went upstairs. But yeah, once like 2011 came around, I had a couple friends that were going to Fun Spot to break a record, and I just tagged along, and then I just kind of realized I had a natural talent for these games, so it just kind of took off from there.
Yeah, what does it take? I mean, these games are like, if you don't play video games and you look at something like Donkey Kong, you don't realize how just deceptively difficult it is. I mean, there's just jump, there's, you know, forward and backward, and yet it's hard.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of like these older games, they were designed to steal your money. You're technically trying to beat a programmer and how he programmed that game. So there's a lot of like hand-eye coordination, recognizing the patterns that programmer made, recognizing if there's random elements and how to deal with them as well. So that's always what appealed to me, is just trying to be a programmer, I guess.
Trace for me, if you will, the like Rocky Balboa montage scene. How did you get from like, hey, I'm going to start playing Donkey Kong with the intention of becoming a world champ, to becoming world champ? What was that like? I mean, like, are you training?
I mean, kind of. So one of my friends, actually, I was going to Fun Spot with, I told him I was going to start playing Donkey Kong, and he just disagreed with it. And then I was just like, well, I just want to maybe get top 20. And he's just like, well, if you do that, I'll buy you a beer every time I go to Fun Spot. So, I mean, I was like, well, that's all the motivation I need. So, but no, I mean, it just took off from there. I just went up to Fun Spot, and I was just trying to learn on their machine, because I had no other way to play. And then that's actually when I met one of my friends, Mike. So he actually showed me a little bit how to play. I kind of like collaborated with a few other people who were also learning the game as well. And then they were showing me all these little tricks, and then I was showing them some tricks that I found out. So it was actually kind of like old school how I learned.
And at this point, I mean, so I had the privilege, I got to see you hit a kill screen the other day. I mean, how often do you just like make a straight up mistake and like lose a man when you don't mean to? At this point, I was like, is he perfect?
No, I make mistakes all the time. And a lot of that just comes out of being really aggressive, because at this point in the game, you have to take a lot more risks than we previously had to. You're kind of battling your brain too, because you do get like almost hypnotized in a way, because you're doing like repetitive strategies, and you're like the screens like repeat itself, and like you'll just like kind of space out, and then something out of the ordinary happens, and like you have to like just adjust to it like right on the spot like that sometimes. But yeah, sometimes you're just not quick enough.
So walk me back, what happened the first time, because you've
beaten your own world champ score and taken it back a few times. But that first time you got to that stage, where were you? What was the scene like?
So the first time I broke the record, yeah, I was actually living in Arizona at the time. I was living in Phoenix, and I bought a cabinet that I wanted to, you know, maybe go for the world record on. So I spent a summer trying to basically learn how to go for the record, and then I started just bringing those strategies into my game. But yeah, when I was out there, I finally got to the end. I barely got past the record. It was like the most exciting thing because I had failed on the last screen for the record to be within a couple thousand points. So just to like just finish the game and have enough points was just like a relief because like, yeah, three times to do that, it just, a third heartbreak would have just been too much.
Yeah. And I mean, like, how long is a world record game at this point?
Yeah, so it's about 3.5 hours right now. You can't pause, you can't take breaks. Yeah, it's just you have to keep that in mind before like you actually start playing a game.
You gotta maybe have a glass of water handy. You gotta like plan it a little bit.
Yeah, like I'll have like maybe a snack and like just one bottle of water, like nothing more, and I'll just try to like stretch that out throughout the entire game if I can.
Yeah.
Even just like other habits that I've changed that actually help my game, like I'll go out and get some exercise. Like I actually dropped weight before I got the record back. And it actually made a difference having 10 less pounds in my lower back, like sitting on my stool.
Yeah, yeah. When you're playing Donkey Kong that long, you're sitting, you got to think about the ergonomics a little bit, right?
Yeah, like you can even see it like on my wrist here. It's like it's always like rubbing against control panel. So, I mean, like even my body's like changed during this whole process.
People play games to have fun, kick back. And then when you even like when you take on something really seriously, all of a sudden it can become a chore, right? Like, do you ever struggle with losing the joy, you know?
1,000%, yeah. Actually, when I was in Arizona, it was becoming like a second job. I was playing probably 30 hours a week. And that was making attempts and trying to still like figure out maybe newer, more aggressive ways to play the game, get more points out of it. So yeah, I spent a good amount of time doing all that as well. So yeah, it's like I said, it's like a job and you're just trying to like not get frustrated over it or annoyed to the point where you just want to quit.
Yeah, you don't need to like, not that you can throw the controller with Donkey Kong.
No, you can punch the machine, but that's about it.
Awesome. Well, thanks for talking to me.
Yeah, man. Yeah, anytime.
You want to go down and just maybe play a game or something? Can I watch you play?
Yeah, sure. Definitely.
Cool.
Yeah.
So that was Robbie Lakeman. And then we went into his basement, and I got to watch him play.
Oh,
wow.
How long did I watch him?
Yeah.
So, I mean, I maybe watched him play for like 20 minutes, and he sort of walked me through what's called point pressing, where you're really, really going for points.
Just milking it as much as you can per level.
Yeah. And then I played a little bit, tried to use some of those techniques, but, you know, I didn't get very far.
So if I'm holding right, that barrel should go down 75% of the time. So this is leeching, is what we're calling it. What we call wild barrels. We call them decision points. Now, what I'm about to do is what we call grouping.
You played there on his machine?
Yeah, and not only is this like his machine, it's in the basement. It's like maybe a foot from the water heater. It's pretty, you know, it's a basement. It's dingy.
Mm. So does he videotape himself playing? Is that how he's setting these records?
Yeah, yeah. He actually has live streamed most of them. And so I've watched... I've watched some of this,
oh, no.
And I must say, it gets pretty intense.
Oh, I was trying to get that rid of that other barrel. God damn it.
And then, oh. And then, you know, when he actually wins the world record.
Yeah!
This game will bring out the worst in people, like by far. Yeah, people are like, oh, why are you getting so upset? Like, why do you have to take this so seriously? I'm just like... I'm like, do you ever see Tom Brady be happy when he throws an interception? I've never seen him be happy with it. So, I mean, that's just like, you know, football is important to him, just like this is important to me. Like, that's just how we are.
I actually tried the other day to see about female Donkey Kong.
Oh, yeah.
Champs. I didn't find anything, which then led me to my theory that I presented to Nick that women have smaller bladders than men. And that when Robbie said that he plays for like 3.5 hours in a single glass of water, I was like, it just feels like there's an obstacle in the way of many women. Not all women, of course.
But I would venture also that there is a
structural and historical reason that there were fewer women playing, especially these types of arcade games.
Well, like myself, I've never played any. I have never played Donkey Kong. I have never heard of basically any of the games that you've mentioned other than Pac-Man, which I've also never played. I'm good at air hockey. Maybe I'm like Justine, like the analog.
Real world gal.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think we're going to learn a little bit more about women and video games in our next segment when we come back from a break.
Excellent. I can't wait to hear it. I'm Erica Janik, and this is Word of Mouth. Your questions answered, your state explored. Today we're talking about video games, and before the break we were talking about video game history, Donkey Kong, and gender. And to continue that conversation, we thought we'd turn to someone who knows a lot about all of these subjects, and many more, Mary Flanagan. Our producer Ben Henry went up to Hanover to speak with Mary, an artist, game designer, professor, and researcher, about her own career in the gaming and game education world, and how the industry is changing.
Can you introduce yourself? Who are you? What do you do?
These are existential questions, Ben. My name is Mary Flanagan. I'm the Fairchild Distinguished Professor of Digital Humanities at Dartmouth College.
And what kind of stuff do you teach your students about?
I teach a range of really experimental courses like game design. I teach classes on mapping and visualization and classes about digital arts and culture.
When did you start working in game design and what was it like? What was the industry like when you started?
When I graduated from graduate school, I moved to Austin, Texas and became a game developer at a small startup company that ended up doing a lot of educational games. So that was in the early to mid-1990s. So I was in the first wave of dot-com digital land, and that was a very exciting time. It was also very strange. You know, no one went to school for video game design. I learned from a bunch of architects and product designers how to go through a design process. I myself was trained as a filmmaker, so it was a very different process than making a film. Films are linear and games are not. And so you're almost designing something that people can enter into and out of more like a building than like a story.
And tell me about the culture of the industry itself at the time. What kind of people were making video games and what kind of feeling were you getting from your industry?
Different companies had different corporate cultures. There was one company down the street where the majority of the company, there were about 200 people at that company, the guys were allowed to hang porn in their office. It was a really derogatory dude culture. And then you have another kind of, I was at more of a design-focused firm, so we had more of an ad agency design firm, so it was a little bit more respectful and inclusive about that kind of stuff. Actually, one guy did have a painting of a geisha on the wall, now that I think about it. So that was pretty bad. So yeah, there were more stereotypical types of things going on at the conferences as well. You know, it wouldn't surprise me to be introduced in very strange ways. Like, Mary's a woman and she's a designer. Like, that was how my CEO once introduced me.
How unusual was it at the time to be a female game designer?
Oh, I don't think it was that common. On the other hand, no one ever wants to tell the story that there are women in games since the beginning. Even in the U.S. board game industry in the 19th century, there are women designing games. So when we moved to digital, it was nothing different. For example, Donna Bailey was the programmer on Centipede. We don't really talk about that. We don't talk about a lot of the women who are really at the forefront of doing games. So it was, I want to say it was unusual, but maybe only because we didn't celebrate or talk about gender. It was just kind of assumed that you would have a certain set of skills and you were probably male.
So you're saying there was a sort of erasure of prominent women in the industry, and part of that, it sounds like, had to do with the stereotype that already existed by that time of video games being by and for men, and young men especially. So can you take me back to like the earliest video games, and when did we start seeing that stereotype emerge?
You know, in early computer labs, when games were first being developed, in the 1950s, for example, the game Tennis for Two was developed as this demonstration of what computers could do that was cool, you know, that was, oh, wow, you could play a game on a computer. That's really cool. And it made computers more palatable. So that's the middle of the 20th century. So what happens when home gaming consoles come out and we have a bigger investment in technology? They still were marketed to families. Look at early Atari ads.
Only Atari makes the world's most popular home video games.
And you'll see whole families playing. There's a few that have like a family starts and then on level 2 they get more relatives over and level 3 they get more relatives over. There's like 40 relatives playing a computer game. Have you played Atari today? That's a very different, you know, family gathering kind of ideology than a lone gamer shooting things idea. You know, like kind of the idea is very different. Some games were advertised in early computer magazines, and those magazine ads tended to be more skewed to computer building hobbyists who could have more been characterized as male. But really, the stereotype really fixed as a kind of permanent thing with the development of first-person shooter games. By the early 1990s, people playing Castle Wolfenstein and Doom and Quake, you end up with a real kind of a real what we call hardcore gamer audience of people who respected certain different things about games and played them differently.
On the other hand, we can think of, you know, some early games like you've talked about Pac-Man, pretty cartoonish, not over-the-top gory, violent. We're not seeing the precursors of first-person shooters in games like that.
No. In fact, early arcade games, Q-Bert, Pac-Man, Centipede, these were very whimsical games. That really nothing. Even if there was a shooting mechanic, it wasn't the same kind of level of the fetishization of what it means to shoot other human beings and have the blood splatter and all of the kind of hyper-realist things that moved the industry forward in terms of 3D graphics and the first-person shooter genre later. You know, there are just whimsical games. Space Invaders, a bunch of like, you know, kind of creepy crawly aliens that are very humorous coming from the sky. They're fun and they're interesting, and they were almost like patterns more than they were like creatures.
And then we discovered first-person shooters. You mentioned Doom, Wolfenstein, Quake. Even as first-person shooters were taking over the market and kind of gaining all this visibility culturally, there were also plenty of games that bucked that stereotype. Can you tell me about like some of these alternative games in the 90s and how did they work?
You have what was the best-selling game of all time for quite a period of time, Myst by the Rand Brothers, which was this kind of fantastic speculative universe where someone falls through a crack in time with a magic book and you have to solve all these puzzles to get back. It's a very moody game. It's nonviolent. It's narrative-based, it's slow, it's dreamy. And that is a very different kind of game than your first-person shooter game. And why that didn't become the model for gaming and for technological development is a curious issue.
I went on to Steam last night, and you can still play Myst for $6.99.
Nice.
And it is, I would almost say, lush. And it's certainly not flashy, and it's not what you think of as like 90s era video games. For some reason, it's not what stuck with us. Why do you think that is?
Partly it could be that our media culture is driven maybe more by violence. Then there was this feedback loop about the kinds of games we're making increase the technological capacity so that this particular graphics card will allow for this high frame rate, this hyper-realism, and more gory violence. And therefore then designing for scenes of gory violence just because that takes advantage of this technological capacity. And really the only thing that's interrupted it was the rise of casual games. You know, the fact that I'm sitting here and no one can diss me over a network channel for playing Candy Crush on my phone, you know? And suddenly you have a whole different group of people who are playing. And in fact, the casual game market is very lucrative. It's very powerful. And the AAA industry has had to deal with that for a long time. Casual games, like things that you could play on your phone, were seen as, oh, well, that's what women play. Those aren't real games. And there was always this disrespect issue. And I think that that is, of course, now going away, partly because of the revenue that companies can actually invest in that space and make something interesting. You know, Pokemon Go was a radical game changer for a lot of people who were not, quote, gamers. That, again, shows us the power when we move away from the stereotypes, we find totally different models of play.
Industry broadly still remains male-dominated in a lot of sectors. A lot of the knowledge that goes into making games is still pretty gendered. How do we go about increasing representation of everyone in this industry?
Games are made by people. And so therefore, they have their people's biases, stereotypes, expectations, cultural baggage, you know. They bring that along. And I think sometimes we forget that games are part of the whole tech industry spectrum, and they definitely suffer from the same kinds of problems Silicon Valley has in terms of diversity, and especially gender diversity, but all kinds of diversity and perspectives. And I think game programs are actually more diverse in terms of who they're attracting than traditional computer science degrees, for example. I'm not sure about that, but I would wager a bet on it. In fact, USC admitted over 50% of their next game design class as women. The women now are doing more game design at USC than men. So that means that people coming out of that program, which is the top program, that means that there's just a bunch of change afoot. Games aren't just pictures of a world or a story about a world. Games actually model a world. So they're like little simulations of worlds or models, and they have a logic built into them. So if we engage with those logics, we become part of that logic. That's why some people reject a particular game, because it's like, that's not the world I value, you know? So what world do we value? If we can say that and we can put that in a game, then we're talking.
That was producer Ben Henry speaking with Mary Flanagan, Fairchild Distinguished Professor of Digital Humanities at Dartmouth College. Coming up, two windows into the video game economy, one from the world of vintage cabinets and antique arcade games, and another from the modern setting of a university classroom. That's when word of mouth continues. What is a vintage cabinet?
Well, a cabinet.
I just read it. This is Word of Mouth. I'm Erica Janik, here with producers Taylor Quimby and Nick Capodice. We've got two video gamey stories left for you, and each one deals with aspects of the video game economy. One of them has to do with the past, and the other with the future. Taylor, cue us up. What are we about to listen to?
Okay, so we were talking about Donkey Kong earlier in the show. We were talking about these vintage arcade games. And did you ever think that it's somebody's job to make sure those things still function?
Yeah.
We're talking about some pretty old games.
Sure, and when it comes to pinball, it's a monster. It's a beast to repair a pinball machine.
So anyway, I found a woman who we will meet in this next segment, and she is a repair person.
She repairs.
She repairs pinball machines and arcade machines, so I went to pay her a visit.
Let's take a listen.
My first and maybe best job ever, sorry guys, was at the Six Screen Movie Theater in Keene, New Hampshire. I applied on my 16th birthday. The free movies were an obvious perk, but even better was the pinball. We played on breaks, after hours. Once I had a key, I even used to skip school to hit the flippers. By senior year, I was probably depositing half of my meager paycheck back to my bosses, two quarters at a time. So maybe, just maybe, you can understand my reaction when I walked into My Arcade Repair in Pelham, New Hampshire.
Oh my goodness. Wow. I see an Addams Family pinball back here.
Yep, Medieval Madness.
It's my all-time favorite game. It's right here?
Yep.
Oh, what shape is this one in? Is it for sale?
It is for sale, yeah.
My Arcade Repair is housed in a three-story multi-car garage. Throughout the building, the gutted corpses of ancient gaming cabinets are frozen in states of half-reanimation. Piles of circuit boards the size of cafeteria trays lay strewn about on nearly every available surface. On a workshop table, chromy widgets of an unknown origin fill plastic containers that once held cherry red ring pops and Twizzlers at some long-closed gas station. It's an alternate universe, a pet cemetery for vintage video games, a post-apocalyptic episode of Stranger Things, and the Dr. Frankenstein of this laboratory is Sarah St. John.
It's like a Willy Wonka factory for pinball nerds.
Pinball nerds, video game nerds, and jukebox nerds.
Sarah is about 6 feet tall, blonde bangs, plain black t-shirt. Looks like she might be into heavy metal, or maybe Pink Floyd. She started fixing arcade machines back in the 1980s.
Every 2-3 days, the cash box were overflowing with quarters, and the quarters would fall on the fuse holders and blow the fuse. So the machines weren't breaking down, they were just overloaded with quarters back in the 80s.
Sarah says she came into the trade at the perfect time. The old-timer she worked with at a vending machine company taught her how to fix all the old mechanical games. And she, with a newly minted electronic engineering degree, could tackle the fancy new video ones.
So what's, I mean, if you've been doing this for 30 years, how has the landscape shifted? I mean,
what I'm finding is a lot more people have either inherited machines or can afford machines now. It's a lot of nostalgia for people in 50s, 60-year-olds, and they want man caves.
If I had to guess, I would have thought the arcade repair economy would be pretty tight in 2018, leaving Sarah to travel miles between rural dive bars for relatively low-paying patch jobs. After all, how much money can you make fixing games that only take in 50 cents at a time? But think about it. Who can afford to keep up a menagerie of vintage arcade games? The collectors. That's who. And for Sarah, who can rebuild an old machine from the ground up the way a custom mechanic can build a new hot rod, business is good.
Well, it's funny. Adam's family, for example, about 10 years ago, I couldn't sell them for $1,200. And today they're going for $7,000 to $8,000.
In order to service the region's arcade buffs without having to scrounge eBay for parts, Sarah has turned a whole floor of her garage into a junkyard, circa 1980.
Oh my god. Oh my goodness.
The basement has huge amounts of circuit boards that are no longer available. So what I do is whenever a machine gets destroyed because of water damage, everything is gutted out of them.
Wow, so we got, looks like Cruisin' USA, classic.
Space Invaders, Double Dragon, Neo Geo, Pac-Man, the classics.
Wow. Man, how do you get through here? This is like, how do you know what everything is? I mean, there's just, like, do you look here and just...
Rows of smudgy gray TV monitors stretch back into the darkness. Sarah tells me she cleaned out 4 dying Radio Shacks in order to keep inventory in-house. She even bought their shelving so she could organize this graveyard into something useful.
From brackets and stuff and drop targets. Playfield posts, there's relays, different contacts, there's slingshots. All different types of metal assemblies, the plunger, rings, light bulbs. It's a huge operation.
Upstairs in the shop is a room that looks like the prop department for a Hollywood movie about NASA's Apollo program. There isn't much room to walk around for all the old boxes of electronics lying around. The walls are lined with maybe a dozen flashy consoles where Sarah can plug in the brains of a pinball machine, the board, and test its circuitry.
So you can read this thing. I mean, I see a lot of flashing lights and numbers.
Yeah, I can pretend the door is open. I can go into the service menu. I can do some diagnostics. I can test some switches.
Can't fix any high scores, can you?
I can get into the memory chips.
Oh, dangerous.
Yes, I am.
Like Liam Neeson in Taken, Sarah has a very particular set of skills that she's acquired over a very long career. But she isn't the only dangerous thing here. The games themselves, left to rot in basements all across New England, can pose their own kind of threat.
You know, I just worked on a game yesterday, Tron, and all of a sudden the power supply just went up in smoke. But that's from the 80s also. So, you know, these electronics are getting old, the capacitors are drying out, the circuit boards are creating cracks in the solder, so they need to be updated.
In her main workshop area, the least cluttered part of my arcade repair, an old Tapper cabinet stands off to one side, and in the center of the room, 3 pinball machines stand shoulder to shoulder. One of them is Bally's 1976 classic, Freedom. Its playboard is propped up like the hood of a car, revealing the mechanical guts inside.
So do you get to, in the process of fixing these machines, I'm guessing you get to play them.
Well, they call that testing. So, yes.
In a separate secret spot that I promised I wouldn't reveal, Sarah shows me a few of her own machines. One of them, my all-time favorite, the 1997 hit Medieval Madness, featuring voice work from SNL alum Tina Fey. This machine, unlike the beat-up one from her workshop that she's still refurbishing, is so finely tuned, so freshly waxed, so beautifully manicured, I couldn't even bring myself to test it. I'm not sure I'd be able to stop. And I can't afford to spend half my paycheck on pinball these days. I guess I'll just have to leave it to the pro.
You ever get pinball wrist?
I do, yeah. It's probably about 10 games in, my hands I have to shake off. But what's nice about it is, you know the machine, like right now, I can just kind of take my hands off the flippers and just wait for the ball to come down.
This is Word of Mouth. That was Taylor Quimby touring My Arcade Repair with Sarah St. John in Pelham, New Hampshire.
Taylor, I can't believe you didn't play the game. Why didn't you play Medieval Madness? That's such a good pinball game.
I know.
Why didn't you play it?
Well, I felt like I didn't have time. Meeting in the afternoon.
Skip the meeting, man.
It was like...
Did you know that Scott Adsit did a lot of those voices, too?
No.
Yeah, Scott Adsit, who also worked on 30 Rock. He did a lot of the voices on Medieval Madness with Tina Fey.
The pinball machine companies must have just like had it in with like sketch comedy people.
It sounds like it.
Well, you could make... Those machines made a ton of money back in the 90s.
Yeah, back in the 90s.
Hmm.
You can buy one for about $8,000 now, Medieval Madness.
When I was lucky, when I was in... Erica, sorry, did you want to pipe in?
Aren't you just immensely impressed and attracted?
Are you bored with us yet?
I'm just like, wow, my life is different.
Okay, let's continue this conversation off the air.
Okay,
Nick.
Let's do that.
Okay, so we're almost done here. At the beginning of the show, I talked about meeting a couple of professors at Southern New Hampshire University and getting to try out this virtual reality headset at their lab in the Manchester campus where they work. But I didn't really tell you anything about the professors themselves, what they teach, and what a modern game development program looks like. So I just kind of wanted to understand with this next little interview, if you need to understand electrical engineering to, say, fix a pinball machine, what are you actually learning if you major in game development?
Story design? Narrative?
Well, listen and find out.
Why don't you just introduce yourself first?
Oh, my name is Ed Berlant. I teach in the game art and development major here at Southern New Hampshire University.
And what are some of the names of your classes?
We have character design, creature design, environment design, digital sculpting, character animation, intro to modeling, concept art and color theory. That's the bulk of the courses that are in the major right now.
Is there a lot of overlap with art or graphic design classes that you see normally in a sort of university setting?
Yeah, well, we do a little bit of overlapping with graphic design, absolutely. Some of the same software that we use, like Photoshop, we both use that. And that's, like, if you think about UI, that has a lot to do with graphic design as well. So there's a little bit of overlap with that. So yeah, there absolutely is between graphic design and what we're doing with game art.
UI is user interface?
It is, UI, UX, yep, user experience.
And if you can introduce yourself.
Yeah, I'm Dave Carrig. I'm the game programming instructor here at SNHU.
And what kind of classes does that entail?
So we have a couple introduction to programming courses. It's just called Game Programming 1, Game Programming 2. And then you hit the ground running. So we have our introduction to game engine courses. We have a game engine development course. We're developing your own game engine. We have a AI for games.
Can I ask, what is a game engine?
Sure. So a game engine is the big complex piece of software that we use to actually develop games. So in the same way that you use Microsoft Word to write an essay, use a game engine to develop your game. There's really sort of two methodologies to developing a game. One is using a game engine that you build or you grab off the shelf that some other company has made, and you're sort of putting all the pieces together to build your game, or you just kind of start from scratch, which is a really big undertaking. So there's a couple courses that we have that sort of teaches the ins and outs of using a game engine, as well as the sort of the guts of a game engine, just because it's a really, really important technology for the industry in general.
So students who come into this major, do they pick one track, and is there overlap between the two sides, or, you know, how does it work?
Yeah, so typically, if you're a game art student, you already, we force our students on both sides to take two courses in the other major. So if I'm a game artist, I'm going to take two programming courses. If I'm a game programmer, I'm going to take two game art courses.
If you kind of imagine the two different roles, if a game programmer sat down and developed a game all by themselves, you might have a very nice functioning game with running and jumping and ducking and rolling and shooting, and everything would just be gray cubes. And then if an artist sat down and they're developing a game by themselves, they would have this beautiful looking game where nothing moves or behaves how it should be. And you try and push buttons and your controller doesn't do anything. So there's also a big dependency between the two majors as well. So we have a handful of courses that students from both majors go through where they're essentially developing projects the entire time. It's very much like you're working at a game studio where you're working across this multidisciplinary team to produce a final project.
Are there people who come to you with questions, like maybe parents who come to you with questions about like, is this a good decision financially for my kid, or even students who wonder what are my prospects coming out of this compared to other sorts of majors that I could go for?
Yeah, absolutely. So one thing that we really try to let people understand is this is a skill set you're learning. Yes, it's games is the avenue that we're showing you how to do this stuff, but it's not only games. And for instance, we've had students that have graduated and they're working in Boston at Wayfair, designing furniture, doing lighting inside of their environments. And we've also had students that have worked at Raytheon as programmers, coming in and doing code for Raytheon, right? So really that skill set is across the board. It can go anywhere, and we want people to know that you're not just making games. You should always be, if games is what you're passionate about, you should always go for it. And everything else, Raytheon, Wayfair, is a stepping stone to get to where you want to go in games. And we really try to push that as much as we can.
That was Taylor Quimby speaking with Ed Brilland and David Carrig of Southern New Hampshire University. Special thanks for today's show goes out to Neil Lorenza of Game Assembly in Manchester, Shauna McGregor, and Sander Lee. If you want to learn more about the inner workings of high-level competitive Donkey Kong, there's an amazingly detailed Donkey Kong blog that outlines all of the strategy. We've got a link at wordofmouthradio.org, along with pictures of Robbie Lakeman, pictures from Taylor's visit to My Arcade Repair, and pictures of Taylor standing awkwardly at SNHU with a virtual reality headset on. This episode was produced by Taylor Quimby, Justine Paradise, and Ben Henry, with help from Jimmy Gutierrez, Hannah McCarthy, and Nick Capodice. Music in this episode from Delay, Uncanny Valleys, Poddington Bear, Kumiku, and Daniel Birch. Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The mysterious gorilla Donkey Kong.
Yeah.
Whatever.
Yeah, we don't know. Do you know why he's called a donkey, even though he's a gorilla?
I don't.